The next person to be killed is Shireen Ebadi. Finding my name on an assassination list in 2000 was surreal, a chilling reward for defending victims of violence in Iran's ports for nearly a decade. The would-be assassin had requested permission to execute me, considering my blood halal as a religious duty. Only after returning home, showering for an hour to wash away the psychological filth, and ensuring my daughters were asleep, did I tell my husband, beginning casually, "So, something interesting happened to me at work today." This moment captures the extraordinary journey of a woman who refused to abandon her principles despite living under constant threat. My story reflects Iran's complex evolution through revolution, war, and oppression, and shows how one voice can challenge an entire system. I was born in 1947 into an upper-middle-class Tehran family where my progressive father treated his daughters and son equally, a rarity in Iran. This foundation spared me from the learned dependence common among women from traditional homes. By 23, I had become one of Iran's first female judges. Then came the 1979 revolution. Like many Iranians, I enthusiastically supported overthrowing the Shah, not realizing I was participating in my own professional demise. Within months, the Islamic Republic declared women unfit to be judges. 6 months pregnant, I faced a purging committee that demoted me to a clerk. My former junior colleagues didn't offer me a seat and spoke about women judges as if I weren't present. I left in rage and somehow reached home with a bloody knee, collapsing in my sister's embrace. The revolution that promised freedom had betrayed half its population. The Iran-Iraq War transformed daily life into a struggle for survival. From my office window, I witnessed mass funerals, the courtyard filled with flag-draped coffins and grieving relatives. The war became inseparable from the revolution, forging its ideology through martyrdom. Young recruits, many just teenagers, boarded buses wearing red bandanas and carrying keys to heaven. Tehran remained in a state of suspended semi-anarchy. I found myself burning politically objectionable books as newspapers announced firing squad executions. The morality police harassed all Iranians, but targeted women with special zeal. We adapted by monitoring our behavior and appearance, though the harassment remained arbitrary and wounding. By the mid-80s, our family struggled financially. I had retired from government service, and my husband's firm was shut down for alleged communist infiltration. With two children and high inflation, we eliminated all luxuries. When the girls wanted to eat out, I created Shireen's restaurant by moving our dining table and taking their orders, teaching them to create opportunities from what they had. In 1992, women were permitted to practice law again. I set up an office but discovered a justice system corrupted beyond repair, where bribes determined outcomes and judges would adjourn court citing my bad hijabi. I abandoned commercial law to focus on pro bono cases that exposed the Republic's unjust laws against women. By the late 1990s, a new wave of terror targeted Iranian intellectuals and writers. After signing an open letter protesting censorship, signatories began disappearing or dying mysteriously. We took elaborate precautions for meetings, changing taxis multiple times and gathering at different locations across Tehran. The case of 11-year-old Leila Fathi became a turning point. After she was raped and murdered, her family had to pay blood money for her killer's executions, because under Iran's Islamic penal code, a man's life is worth twice a woman's. Her father sold everything but fell short. My article exposing this inequality, where a man's testicle was valued equal to a woman's life, electrified Tehran, with issues selling out immediately. I later organized a memorial for 9-year-old Aryan Golshani, who died after repeated abuse from her father. Despite neighbors reporting her dungeon-like conditions, 33-pound weight, broken arms, and cigarette burns, the court had denied her mother custody. The memorial evolved into a protest against child custody laws. My call for legal reform sparked street chants, generating publicity that made women's custody rights central to public discourse. The Islamic Republic's methods differed from the Shah's savak. The regime targeted even translators of French literature. They abandoned public trials and executions in favor of covert operations, staged accidents, fake robberies, stabbings, and potassium injections causing heart attacks. After representing families of victims killed during student protests, I was arrested in 2000. At Evin Prison, I endured a filthy solitary cell under constant light with no windows. I prayed 5 times daily and exercised to maintain sanity. After 25 days, I began hallucinating and carved into the wall, "We are born to suffer because we are born in the third world." In September 2003, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee called me during a Paris seminar. Returning to Tehran, hundreds of thousands, mostly women with flowers, greeted me after walking miles through jammed roads. University students sang Yare Dabistani, the pro-democracy anthem, with its hopeful line, "Whose hands but mine and yours can pull back these curtains?" The prize brought international attention, but increased dangers. Threats multiplied, surveillance intensified, and regime propaganda portrayed me as a Western agent. Yet I refused to leave Iran, believing I would be useless abroad. The greatest threat was our own fear. Despite oppression, Iranian women have made remarkable progress, with 65% of university students and 43% of salaried workers now being women. Ironically, the Islamic Revolution created educational opportunities for traditional women through segregated Islamic universities, removing patriarchal barriers to education. Girls whose mothers were homebound found themselves pursuing knowledge in cities. This quiet revolution continues beneath the surface, as small acts of defiance, a visible strand of hair, a woman driving alone at night, a girl pursuing education despite family pressure, collectively reshape Iranian society from within. Iran needs a peaceful transition to democracy. Iranians are weary of violence, yet face imprisonment for dissent. The West should pursue diplomacy instead of military threats, which only strengthen the regime and weaken civil society. I know transforming Iran peacefully may cost my life, but I continue because I believe in my country's potential. Iran's thousands of years of history include periods of enlightenment, tolerance, and cultural flowering. The current regime is just a moment in this long arc, not our destiny. What sustains me is knowing no government can permanently suppress the human desire for dignity and freedom. I've witnessed this in young women studying law, mothers fighting for child custody, and writers risking everything for truth. Remember, change comes from persistent, everyday resistance. The most powerful weapon against tyranny isn't violence, but refusing to surrender your principles. When faced with injustice, will you remain silent for safety, or will you speak, knowing your voice might be the one that finally breaks through?